Dear friends, this is the first lecture in the course Perspectives on Bhikkhuni Ordination, held by the Women in Buddhism Study Initiative in cooperation with the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies, both at the University of Hamburg. We welcome you to this virtual classroom, where for the next weeks we will explore women's ordination in the three Buddhist traditions from the legal and historical perspectives and from the lived experiences of nuns around the world. I am asked to say a few words regarding how this course came to be. In 2007, the University of Hamburg held an international congress on Buddhist women, which brought together senior Buddhist monastics from around the world, including His Holiness the Dalai Lama, as well as academic scholars, to share the research findings on issues related to women's ordination. The work of these scholars is cutting edge in each of their fields, whether it is history, archaeology, or the study of Buddhist texts. This work unveils an inspiring human story of collaboration between men and women over 2,600 years to sustain, at times in great difficulty, the fourfold Sangha, which the Buddha established as the solid foundation on which his teachings could continue. Yet this scholarly work remains largely hidden from the mainstream. After the Congress, I was eager to find a university where I could continue to study what had been presented in more detail. I was disappointed to find only one university course in the world that specifically touched on women in Buddhism, even though I had heard more than 60 scholars speak at the Congress. While exploring Buddhist studies courses, I heard a distinguished professor refer to a text that suggested the Buddha was reluctant to ordain women. Because I had attended the Congress, I knew that the origin, the content, and the context of this text had long since been proven dubious. Yet people continued to assume it was true and pass it on to others. I therefore made the determination to invite a new beginning, one that would enable this scholarship to be more widely read, that would invite practitioners to investigate the issues for themselves, that would invite Buddhist scholars and monastics to continue the process of mutual learning, which was cultivated during the Congress. In this way, the proposal for a program on women in Buddhism, teaching, study, research, and dialogue was drafted and sent to Venerable Karma Lakshya Tsomo, co-founder and past president of Sakadisa International Association of Buddhist Women. Venerable Lakshya suggested that the ideas be presented at the Sakadisa International Conference on Buddhist Women in India in January 2013. Together, we then took the idea to the University of Hamburg, where Venerable Jampa Tsedrun convinced the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies and the Academy of World Religions to jointly convene a roundtable discussion in June of last year to determine what concrete steps could be taken to bring this proposal to life. One of the outcomes of the discussion was the decision to initiate an e-learning course focused specifically on ordination, which we begin today. It is our vision to do more than just this course. Already a second e-learning course is planned, and in the longer term, we hope the initiative will encourage teaching, study, research, and dialogue in this important area to flourish. This course is offered free of charge, thanks to the generosity of each lecturer who has agreed to give his or her time for no compensation other than the sheer joy of sharing their life's work with all of us. Venerable Analio has coordinated the entire course, and in keeping with the code of conduct of the so-called forest tradition, he remains an unsalaried professor. The online classroom is a very new type of learning space for most of us. With more than 300 participants from 52 countries enrolled in this class, things may malfunction from time to time. We are invited to reflect the generosity of our hosts and the guest lecturers by practicing patience in the event that things do not run perfectly. There are many benefits to be gained by exploring this topic. We can strengthen our knowledge of the texts and the lived experiences of people who put them into practice. We can also deepen our understanding of the social context in which things have come to be, looking deeply into the dilemmas people face in living up to the Buddha's ideal of the Fourfold Sangha. In this way, we can learn to hold a skillful space for the diversity of views on women's ordination in the Buddhist world. I would like to express my heartfelt gratitude to each and everyone for this chance to learn from multiple perspectives represented by the 12 scholars and the attendees, who include lecturers, professors, university students, lay Buddhist practitioners, as well as friends from other religious traditions and non-religious fields. May our learning together bring us great joy and benefit countless beings today and in future generations.
So thank you very much, Lisa, for this beautiful introduction to the course. So now we want to start in series. The course begins with a Madhyama Agama discourse. This is, in a way, a lead over for those of you who have been with me in the past 3 years, where we have been doing similar e-learning courses on different topics, all of them based on comparing the Madhyama Agama with its parallels. For those of you who are new, what is this Madhyama Agama? The Madhyama Agama is a text that is preserved in Chinese translation, but this text is comparable in type to the Majjhima Nikaya, the collection of middle-length discourses, which we have in Pali. And in principle, this Madhyama Agama has the same claim to being an authentic record of the Buddha's words as the Majjhima Nikaya, except, of course, for the fact that being preserved in Chinese translation, there is always the possibility of translation errors. But this Madhyama Agama was transmitted in Kashmir, brought by a Kashmirian monk to China. He learned Chinese and he translated it into Chinese. The fact that it is preserved in Chinese doesn't mean that the collection itself is any Chinese or influenced by Chinese ideology. The Madhyama Agama is an Indian text and is a record of what tradition believes to have been the word of the Buddha. In the first part of my lecture, we will go together through the Madhyama Agama parallel, as you can see here, Madhyama Agama 116, Discourse on Gotami. And this is the parallel to an Anguttara Nikaya discourse, as well as a passage in the Theravada Vinaya. And these are on the topic of how the Buddha is recorded to have started an order of nuns. And this foundation account is symptomatic for developments, tendencies, and ideas that inform the history of Buddhist women, in particular monastic Buddhist women, throughout Buddhist history. I already want to say now what are the two main things I'm aiming at, the two main things that I hope you will take along from this lecture. One is that we can discern three types of attitudes towards women in Buddhist texts. These have been, I'm following the formulation of a scholar called Sponberg, and later on in the PDF you will see them also written with the bibliographical information. One is so-called soteriological inclusiveness. This means women are seen as capable as men to reach the highest goal. The second one is called institutional androcentrism. This means that within institutions and hierarchies, men dominate. And the third is ascetic misogyny. This is full-fledged hatred of women. And we need to be aware of all these three attitudes as we work with this or any other text, or even with those who report to us during the course about their findings in modern-day situation. Should not just focus on one of these three, but be aware of all of these three in and when they manifest. I'm not only trying to look at these three attitudes with you together today, I also want to introduce two different ways of reading, in particular of reading Vinaya text. The Madhyama Agama discourse, the Anguttara Nikaya discourse, these are actually discourses, but the origin or the most prominent place of this account of the foundation of the Bhikkhu order is in the Vinayas, and we find them in pretty much all Vinayas that have been preserved It is, in essence, a Vinaya text, and we have several examples for textual passages moving from the suttas to the Vinaya, from the Vinaya to the sutta. Now, when we look at such a Vinaya text, there are two different ways we can look at it. One is what I call the historical critical reading. Historical critical reading means what we will be doing in the first part of this lecture. We look at the text, we look at its parallels, and we try to determine whether differences, what differences are there, what can these differences tell us about the evolution of a particular story. Another reading is what I would call a legal reading. This is, for example, for me as a Buddhist monk ordained in the Theravada tradition. I will read the Theravada Vinaya in order to understand how I am expected to follow certain rules. This is quite a different reading, and the legal reading is relevant for a particular purpose. Its purpose is to understand this particular text, what does it mean in legal terms. And at that point, it's quite irrelevant what other Vinayas say. And another one is the historical critical reading, where I try to understand the historical development. I just wanted to throw this out for you now, so that you already know what I'm trying to get over. And we'll come back to both of them in the course of the lecture. So now we start with the discourse on Gotami, and I give you some time to read the text that is now on the screen, from Thus Have I Heard down to the line there. So, in the Madhyama Agama version, we find that Mahapajapati Gotami herself expresses this question, she makes this point that can women become arahants? This is the fourth fruit of recluseship. This refers to full awakening. And if that is so, then should the Buddha not allow them to become monastics? Which is in early Buddhist thought is seen as the best way to actualize one's spiritual potential. And the Buddha replies no, but he gives her an alternative option. He says, Gotami, you can shave your hair, you can wear monastic robes, and practice the holy life. And this exchange happens two times. So here we have the Pali version. I'll let you read again. So what is particularly significant here is, one, this is not in the passage we are seeing now, that in the Pali version it is not Gotami herself who mentions the potential of women. But in particular, if we read the Pali version, we get the impression that the Buddha just gives a wholesale refusal. No going forth for women. Whereas in the Chinese, and I'm just going back to get that last part here, he says, he gives her the option of living what I understand to refer to a sort of semi-monastic life, where she does not go forth wandering around in India, but she is allowed to shave off her hair and put on monastic robes. And as I've argued in my article, this alternative option is not found only in the Madhyama Agama, but also in several other texts. Moreover, in those Vinayas and other texts where this option is not mentioned, we still find that the account continues by saying that Gotami and her followers, actually they did shave off their hair and put on monastic robes and followed the Buddha. And in none of these other texts, this creates any kind of criticism by the Buddha or even a remark by him. And this is rather unusual. If the Buddha had indeed just said no, as he does in the Pali version, it is quite inconceivable for the story to continue with Gotami Mahaprajapati on herself undertaking such an action. That would be an open act of defiance of the Buddha. And in all of these Vinaya texts and also in the suttas that account this story, it is quite clear that Gotama is a stream enterer at the present juncture of events. For a stream enterer to undertake such an action is pretty much out of question. In considering the situation, it seems fairly probable that an earlier account of the founding of the Order of Nuns did have this alternative option proposed by the Buddha in the Madhyama Agama account, and that this was lost in the course of transmission in those versions where this is not found now. This hypothesis changes completely the main perspective, the main message that this account gives. It is no longer a question of the Buddha just not wanting women to go forth at all, but much rather it is a question of the Buddha being concerned that in the ancient Indian setting, for women to go forth and then wander around freely could be causing problems. We know that there were several cases of rape of Buddhist nuns. We also know from Jaina texts that rape was a real problem for Jaina nuns to defend themselves against. In the ancient Indian setting, a woman was seen obviously in an inferior position, and she was seen as someone who needs to be protected by father, husband, or son. And as soon as she moves out of this protective area and was on her own, there was a danger that she would be perceived by males as an easily available commodity on a line with prostitutes. So for women to be shaven-headed, wearing robes, walking around freely, was simply a rather dangerous issue. And so in this situation, and we don't know exactly when to place the founding of the Order of Nuns, but this is indications we have point to about 5 years after the Buddha had started teaching. So we are at a stage of the Buddhist order where it's just in its beginning, and even the Buddha sometimes didn't have a proper place to sleep. There's a story about his son Rahula spending the whole night on the toilet because he didn't have any proper place to lie down. In such a situation where accommodation was difficult to get by, the order was just beginning to pick up, it is actually not difficult to understand why the Buddha would say, okay, you want to go forth, you want to become a monastic, now you can do that, but please stay at home, stay in the protected environment, Kapilavastu, maybe stay there in the garden or whatever. But don't start wandering around freely, because that will be difficult. That could create problems. So here's a question by Sikamanabua. But weren't there women renunciants equivalent of bhikkhunis in the Jain and other religious tradition at that time? Yes, I think I mentioned already that in the Jaina tradition, women were already ordained. There were Jaina monastics, and we have these stories about them being threatened by rape. In fact, as quite drastic, the Jain tradition places a lot of emphasis on non-harming, but when it comes to protecting the nuns from unwanted intruders, they are actually encouraged to take a stick in their hand and stand by the door ready to beat up anybody who's trying to get into the nunnery. And even the monks, the Jaina monks, are asked to help and protect the nuns. So as far as we are able to reconstruct from the sources we have, the Shramanas, female Shramanas, Jain Shramanas, Jain female monastics, and later Buddhist female monastics, were in a somewhat precarious situation, and they had to learn how to carve out a place for themselves in ancient Indian society, where they are not seen as an easily available commodity, but actually being respected. This is something difficult for us to understand when we come from a modern day situation of Buddhist Kranti, like I think of my own experience, Sri Lanka or Thailand, Burma. It's unconceivable that somebody would look at a nun as an object to satisfy sexual desires. But in ancient India, the situation apparently was different. And to entertain you, I have a little picture here. This is from Gandhara. This is apparently the Mahaprajapati and her followers requesting from the Buddha to going forth. And on the other side, that would be Ananda and some other monks. There, the issue of we always need to be aware of that we are not only building our ideas on texts, but also have this aspect of archaeology. And in the course of our lectures, there will be one lecture by Peter Skilling on inscriptions and such evidence, just to round up the picture that we are constructing. Good, I think we can go on to the next part. Again, I would ask you to read. So we have this touching scene of Gotami. She's standing outside the entrance. That's quite significant, kind of symbolizing her situation. And Venerable Ananda then being willing to intervene. He will talk to the Buddha about this. Before I continue, just to reply to Lisa, this is at the British Museum, the Gandhara image. Let me continue with the Madhyama Agama version again. Let you read. So here we get Ananda's intervention. He also mentions the ability of women, which in the Pali version, this is the first time that this topic comes up. And the Buddha says no. And he says, and this is important, this holy life will consequently not last long. Holy life is brahmacharya, which refers to celibacy. And so my hypothesis, based on what we have seen in the first part, is that this was the original point of this passage. That this was originally about the brahmacharya, the celibate life of the nuns being in danger, that it won't last long because of the problems around them, because of the threats to their celibacy. And that in the course of time, during transmission, because monks were perceiving nuns as a problem, particularly after the Buddha had passed away, they would have interpreted this to mean that the very presence of nuns at all in itself is a threat to the sasana, to the holy life. And I'm basing my suggestion not only on this aspect that we have been looking at before, where we get the, and I just go back a little bit, just to remind us. I'm not basing myself only on this suggestion that she should shave off her hair, put on monastic robes, and practice the holy life, but also on a number of other passages which I've surveyed in my article, which show that leaving aside the foundation account, there are so many other passages which clearly point to the Buddha wanting to have an order of nuns from the outset, and to an order of nuns being something positive, something that strengthens the dispensation, something that makes an important contribution. And this one, especially if it's read in the way that the very presence of an order of nuns is a problem, is in absolute contrast to all these other passages. Some more reading. I'm sorry, we had that already. This one, yeah, the Pali version. So here we also get this simile of the families, many women and few men, which I understand then to play on the same sense, to convey us this idea that many women and few men, there are few men to defend the women, and so they're easily assailed. And in the Anguttara Nikaya, then the text continues with the promulgation of the Garu Dharmas, principles of respect, to which we will soon turn. Maybe I just wait if there's any questions so far before turning to the Garu Dhammas. Good, then we continue. So the Buddha, in this account, proposes these eight principles to be respected as a condition for allowing Gotami to go forth. So let me see if I can get them all on the screen. Almost. Good. Time for you to read. I move it up a little bit. So by now, if we look back at what we have seen, we have already come across these three attitudes I mentioned at the beginning. We saw the attitude of soteriological inclusiveness, where it is clearly affirmed that women are as capable as men of awakening. We also saw the tendency towards negativity towards women, maybe not full-fledged ascetic misogyny, but going in that direction in the way how this refusal by the Buddha to start an order of nuns slowly becomes more pronounced and in the end looks as if it's just a wholesale refusal. And here we come to the institutional androcentrism. It's very clear that in this description here, the order of nuns is placed into an inferior position. Nuns, let's go to them one by one. So a nun, for getting higher ordination, she has to approach the monks. Also, the nuns every half month have to approach the monks to get instructions. A nun is not allowed to spend the rainy season retreat in a place where there are no monks. And after the rainy season retreat, she has to ask. This is an invitation to be pointed out any shortcomings that one has had during this period. And whereas as a monk, I only need to ask this to the other monks. If I'm a nun, I have to ask the monks and the nuns. And then there is this about not being even asked a question. We can see that the Abhidharma is mentioned, which already shows some later influences, as the Abhidharma only came into being after the Buddha had passed away. And I understand the point to be in particular challenging questions, not just a simple question, but questions that could be perceived by others as a challenge to authority. And the same theme then with the next one, that a nun should not point out when a monk has done an offense, but a monk can point it out for a nun. And if a nun has committed an offense, there is something, there's a procedure for us monastics that when we have broken one of our rules, a serious rule, then we will be temporarily suspended, which means we are still monks, but we lose our position in the monastic hierarchy. And we also have to tell any monastic we meet, look, I'm under suspension for so and so much of time now. And in the case of a nun, she has to do that with both assemblies, the assembly of monks and the assembly of nuns. And lastly, the issue of respect. The monastic order is structured such that independent of however much I know, whatever much meditation practice I have done, when I meet another monk, we establish a hierarchy between each other based on how long we have been ordained. So if I have been ordained for 7 years, let's say, and another monk for 2 years, then the other monk has to pay respect to me. If the other monk is 20 years ordained, then I have to pay respect to him. And in the case of nuns, this principle is simply any nun has to pay respect whenever she meets a monk. And here I have a survey of the Pali versions. So I am listing the rules briefly on the left side from the Madhyama Agama, and then on the right side those corresponding ones from the Pali version, and I'm giving their number as they come in a different sequence. So I'll let you have a look at this for some time. So the first one is about higher ordination. And in the Pali version, we have a more detailed indication there. This refers to a sikkhamana is a reference to a training period for 2 years that a female candidate has to undergo in order to qualify for higher ordination. But the basic principle is the same in as much as here too the Bhikkhu Sangha, the community of monks, has to be involved in the ordination procedure. And the second one, we have a slight difference of formulation. It's in particular to ask also about the date when the instruction should take place, and also of the uposatha, which is the time when monastics who live in a single building assemble together to recite the code of rules. And asking about the date, we have to remember we are in ancient India 2,500 years ago. So the date, the proper date for the uposatha has to be determined by looking at the moon. And not everybody is skilled in that. And it's sometimes when you look at the full moon, you get this, you're not really sure. Is it full moon today or is it still going to be full moon tomorrow? So there's always some uncertainty about the date. Rainy season retreat and invitation are the same. Ask questions here. It's the Pali is stronger, not insult or revile, which confirms what I said earlier. The issue is not about simple questions, but about questions that are challenging. And expose offenses has its counterpart in not admonishing. And then the observance of manatta of penance and the paying of respect are again the same. So what we get here, if we look at it again, if you just imagine the historical situation, order of monks is already in existence, and out of a sudden then there are these Gotami and 500 other nuns become ordained. At that point, assuming that some of the basic Vinaya observances would have already in place, it makes sense to say, let the nuns follow the example of the monks, let the monks teach the nuns the way how to do these things. But out of that, it seems there has clearly developed a system which definitely is a good case for the so-called institutional androcentrism. And we may wonder if it was really meant to be for eternity, for as long as the sasana lasts, to be in this way. There's a question here by Sikkhamanabua. So does that mean in Mahayana tradition bhikkhunis can insult revile monks and admonish them? What qualification does a monk need to have to be able to admonish nuns? Yeah, so first of all, I think we need to distinguish Mahayana from speaking about monastic lineages. Mahayana is, and this is quite important, and it's very happy that you brought this up, Mahayana is not a monastic tradition. This is often, especially in Theravada circles, being confused. Nowadays, we have three monastic traditions. One is the Theravada, one is the Dharmaguptaka, and one is the Mula Sarvastivada. And being a member of this tradition means that you are a monastic, you are a Buddhist monk or a nun, and you commit to following the rules in the way these are being passed down in these three different traditions. Being a Mahayana is a different thing. This is a vocational issue. It's a decision that you are practicing with the aim of becoming a future Buddha, and you are basing this practice on a particular text or several texts out of what we in generally refer to as Mahayana Buddhist literature. And as an aside, I just like to mention that in the Theravada tradition, South and Southeast Asia, the aim, the path of the Bodhisattva, the aim at becoming a future Buddha, is also known and practiced. Only it is just a more exceptional form of practice, whereas in what we call the Mahayana countries, China and Far East Asia, Tibet and Himalayan countries, the path of the Bodhisattva is pretty much standard. There is sometimes a joining of these insofar as a monastic who ordains in the Dharmaguptaka, which is China, Korea, etc., or in the Mula Sarvastivada tradition, Tibet, etc., will at the conclusion of the ordination rite also be given the Bodhisattva precepts. But this joining does not mean that we can consider the Mahayana as a monastic tradition by itself. So we would have to reformulate your question and say, so does it mean that in the Dharmaguptaka tradition or in the Mula Sarvastivada tradition, bhikkhunis can insult and revile monks and admonish them? And then we will have to look at the Garu Dharmas, or Guru Dharmas in Sanskrit, and we will find that there we have similar stipulations. The other question, what qualification does a monk need to have to be able to admonish nuns? Well, generally we would expect that this monk has to be a senior monk and of good conduct. In fact, we get some stories in the Vinaya as a recurrent trope of six monks, and we also have six nuns, and these are like the naughty people, and they do all kind of mischief. And one of these stories, whatever its historical value, of the six monks, and they want to attract some of the bhikkhunis to them. They're infatuated with them, and so they do all kind of silly things. I think they to sprinkle them with mud or with water and all kind of foolish things. And then this matter is reported, and the Buddha gives a rule that the nons don't even have to pay respect to them. These are made unrespectful. How does one say that in English? They are put into a category of not being worthy of respect anymore. So these monks would certainly not be qualified to admonish a nun. So here I have these three attitudes again. And I find this eminently useful. And below I'm giving you the bibliographical information of the article in which this appeared. And as far as in my own reading of studies of women in a Buddhist tradition, this has been very, very much used. He has a fourth category which has not so much made its way, but these three basic attitudes, I find this very useful to look at the text in this terms. And as far as I'm able to determine from my own reading so far, the first two, on the soteriological inclusiveness and the institutional androcentrism, seem to stem from right from the beginning. But the ascetic misogyny seems to be particularly a later development. And I would be very happy if we can take these three attitudes with us during the coming lectures and doing our explorations of the position of women in Buddhism in this course and even in the next year. There's some more questions now. Stefan, are the eight Garudamas authentic words by the Buddha? Yeah, the way they have come down to us now makes it improbable that they are authentic words of the Buddha. But we still need to study and understand them, because particularly when we come to shifting perspective towards a legal reading, these are part of the Vinayas of each of these three Vinaya traditions that I mentioned before, the Theravada, South and Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, the Dharmaguptaka, China, Korea, etc., and the Mula Savastivada, Tibet and Himalayan countries. And we have to understand where they come from, how they evolved, and what their actual implications are. And it's particularly interesting that several of these Garudhammas or Guru Dharmas recur as rules in the Pachitya section of the Vinaya. And so it seems somewhat puzzling that the Buddha would first point out these, and then later on actual rules would be created. And some of these, if they would have been followed from the beginning, some of these rules could not have come into being. And this is particular one case, numbered as number 6 here in the Pali part on the Sikkamana. If there had been a 2-year training period from the outset for any female candidate, if the Buddha, let us assume the Buddha says there has to be this period, and he says it right at the beginning, and Mahapajapati says, yes, I accept this happily, and we will do it like this. And this 2-year training period includes, of course, the observance of celibacy. But then in some Vinayas, we get the story of what happened when a woman who was pregnant became a nun, and then how to deal with the child. And if they had observed the Sikkamana period, it would have been impossible for this to happen. So there are several scholars who, and I would include myself among them, who think that these Garudhammas, at least in the way we have them now in the different Vinayas, cannot be authentic records of the word of the Buddha. But it is easier for us to say what is probably not authentic than to say what is authentic, because we have to keep in mind that all these texts that we have, suttas and Vinayas, are the final product of a long process of oral transmission. And invariably some changes have come into them the way they are now. So it is quite difficult for us to say what is the authentic word of the Buddha. But what we can say is, what is the early Buddhist attitude or the early Buddhist presentation of a particular topic? And when we say that, we are speaking about the period of 400 to 200 before Christ, just very roughly speaking, say from the time when the Buddha lived, who knows when that was exactly, but roughly 200 years up to the time of King Ashoka. During that period, as far as we are able to tell, the early discourses and the main portions of the Vinaya would have come into being. And this is something that we can say in early Buddhism, such and such a thing is seen, such and such a way. And then in later tradition, including the Theravada tradition, which begins only with the coming of Buddhism to Sri Lanka during the time of King Ashoka, his son Mahinda, and later Sanghamitta. In the Theravada tradition, this is seen in this way. In the Mahayana tradition, this is seen in this way. But it is not really possible for us to put down our feet and say, this is authentic word of the Buddha. This is exactly what the Buddha said. Unfortunately, we can't do that. Next question, Samaneda Madina. Qualities required of a monk to be qualified to instruct nuns. Oh, she gives a reference. Anguttara Nikaya. And Wei and Shaw, right on the spot, no parallel. Thanks to both of you. So we continue reading. I move it a little bit. So Gotami comes here and says that she would like that elderly nuns, senior nuns, nuns who have been ordained for a long time, are respected by younger monks. And this is quite puzzling, because if she really accepted these Karudamas, and thereby we come back to the question asked by Stephen Springer, if she really happily accepted these Karudamas, then why would she want to change this? And so it seems to me, if we are talking about attempting to reconstruct an earlier version of this account from a historical perspective, it seems much more probable that, in keeping with the situation in ancient India, the monks would not have paid respect to the nuns. And when this became noticeable, obviously only after several nuns had become senior, so a number of years must have passed since the order of nuns was started, then they approached the Buddha and asked him to regulate this. And so the Buddha then says no. Yeah, in the Pali we have the same, and I'm just giving you the first part of the Chinese. In the Pali Vinaya, the Buddha says that even other heterodox practitioners, it means other religious groups in ancient India, did not permit for men to pay respects to women. So how could he do that? We do not get such an explanation here in the Madhyama Agama. The basic point behind that seems to be, reading the Pali version, concerned with ancient Indian etiquette. It was already apparently quite some outstanding move to establish an order of nuns. We have a precedence in the Jnana tradition, but still, in the ancient society, this was not a usual path to take. And there were a number of problems, if you read the Vinaya, in trying to enable women to live the monastic life to the fullest without the order as a whole running the danger of losing the respect of the laity. There are a number of occasions where, for example, when the nuns approach the monks for these instructions, which we saw earlier in the Gaudodhamma, then people suspected that they were having love affairs with each other. So there was a whole problematic situation of trying to negotiate between the need, especially by the monks, to give the nuns all the support that they required in order to build up their own monastic tradition, but at the same time avoiding that this gives the impression to the laity that the monks and the nuns had improper relationships, which of course would directly undermine the main source of income of the monastics, because they depend on the laity for their food. Now, in the Madhyama Agama version, this request by Gotami, which I assume then may have later led to this idea that the Buddha said this already at the outset, leads on to a whole outburst of negativity towards women. But just to, before we go into this, just to conclude what we said about these Garudhammas or Guru Dharmas, it's important to keep in mind that these principles of respect are not monastic rules. Monastic rules are always pronounced in the Vinayas in response to a particular situation that has arisen, and they carry with them a penalty. Sometimes it's a very minor one, sometimes a major one. These are not, the Garudhammas themselves are not rules because they are not spoken in reply to a situation. They are anticipatory, and they also do not carry any penalty, except for those that have later on become rules. So in the case of this paying of respect, which when we look at these Garudhammas from a feminist perspective seem particularly offensive, it needs to be kept in mind that this is not a rule. A nun, say now, if a nun comes and meets me and she does not pay respect, nothing happens. She has not broken a rule, there's no penalty for that. So these are, maybe we can call them recommendations. Recommendations on how the, and I assume the origin of these stories from the very first period of the coming into being of the nun's order, recommendations how the nun should conduct their affairs so that they are in harmony with the monks. And in this last case, as I said, I doubt that the rule is original. It seems to rather come off of that story and not something being said at the beginning, but it carries no penalty. Just a recommendation. And in fact, there's a rule only for monks. Monks are not permitted to pay respect to women. But whether a female monastic pays respect to a male monastic, at least in the Pali Vinaya, I don't remember the other Vinayas, there is no rule, there's no penalty on this issue. So simply, if we talk in modern day situation for a bhikkhuni in the Theravada tradition, it's simply up to her. She decides how she feels she should conduct herself in that situation, whether she wishes to follow that recommendation or not. But now we get into misogyny. Maybe we just finish that part, if you read. So what we get here is a description of the people spread their clothes on the ground and say, please walk on this. This is appears to be an observance in ancient India. It is somewhat auspicious. If you put your clothes and some saintly person walks over them, this is a kind of blessing that you get. And not only their clothes, they also do it with their hairs. Spread their hair on the ground and then, please walk on it, please step on it. So this description gives us the feeling that from the perspective of those responsible for this passage, there's a clear perception that the coming into being of an order of nuns diminishes the respect that they receive. And as I said, there are clear grounds also for that perception, because in order to look after the nuns or protect them against others, monks have to get involved in areas that are somewhat gray areas, and that may indeed in some cases have diminished respect and lay people suspecting that they're having some affairs with each other. Let me now look at some of these questions here. Samane Dhammadinna says there are no direct parallels to the Angad. We are still with the qualities of a monk, but similar requirements are mentioned in the Mula Savastivada Vinaya. Thank you. Champat Sedrun, is there a Theravada rule that prohibits samaneras to pay respect to a bhikshuni? I would have to look that up, Champala. I am not able to reply to that question offhand. Wayne Cho, also wondering, how complete are the sutta central indication of parallel? Well, it is a work in progress, Wayne, but I mean, the sutta central only gives discourse parallels. And Venerable Sujata has just been telling me that he's now really working very hard on the different Vinayas. So soon enough, we will have all the Vinaya correspondence, which would be a very helpful aid for our studies. And then we will no longer need to rely on the article by Gregory Chopin or other secondary literature, as Samaneya Dhammadinna has mentioned. But we will be able actually to match these kind of rules. Would we continue with our texts? A time for you to read again. And it's slowly getting a little bit hilarious, I find, because these descriptions was like, I mean, I lived as a monk begging my food in Sri Lanka, and saw this idea that these people stand there and say, by the words, please take this and eat this, take as much as you like, and then even lead you in the house and anything, take anything you like, please, please, please take it all. It's just so funny. But obviously it's not so funny actually, because it's really an expression of this third attitude of ascetic misogyny. This feeling that if there were no nuns, then our monk life would be a pure paradise. We would get everything that we want. But now these nuns are there and we lost it. All this has no parallel in the Pali version, but I think it's still important for us to look at these, to get a feeling, to get an understanding of this attitude of negativity towards women. And this projecting of any difficulty that I as a monk may experience when I go begging, and immediately I have a culprit for that. See, I didn't get food. See, these nuns, nobody's respecting us anymore. Yeah. Still continues. So we get this imagery of Buddhist monastics, religious recluses, would be as powerful as the sun and the moon. And they would also, and this is quite important, those lifeless, skinny, heterodox practitioners. This is obviously a reference to other religious groups in the ancient Indian sitting. And we get behind that this whole feeling of a competition and the need to establish oneself as the worthy recipient of support, in competition with giants, paribhajikas, ajivikas, whatever it is. And then the culmination point is this prediction, which has an incredible impact. And this prediction is also found in all versions. This prediction has had an incredible impact on the way male monastics perceive female monastics in all the Buddhist traditions. It's this idea that the right teaching would have remained for 1,000 years, and because they are nuns, now it remains only for 500 years. Of course, when 500 years had actually passed and the teaching continued, then traditions had to find different ways of arguing, reinterpreting this. I have no explanation for how this idea came into being. It's something that still puzzles me. It makes very little sense from the perspective of other early Buddhist passages. It's there. We just have to be aware of it and of its impact. And another outburst of negativity. So the various ruling position a woman could assume in the spiritual realm, on the world, in the heavens, she's not able to do that. And this particular inability of women is the topic of another discourse. It does not occur in the parallel versions to the foundation account, but it occurs in the Bahudhātaka Sutta. And I have done a detailed study, and I believe I've shown that this is also very clearly a later development. And here we get the same prediction in the Pali version. I'll let you read. In my personal experience, discussing this question of bhikkhuni ordination with particular traditional monks, I often have the impression that this fear of decline is a very strong motivating factor, and that this particular prediction has had incredible impact on the thinking of later generations. So, yeah, we will now do a change of perspective. We have looked at these three different attitudes as they emerge in the text, and now we come to the two different readings. I'll let you read what I've written there. So what I'm proposing here is that there is no single, always true, correct, and right form of reading a text. Reading of a text simply depends on the context and what we are trying to achieve. And so in the case of Vinaya text, there are simply two main reading modes that I want to introduce, and one is the critical historical reading, a little bit what we have been doing so far, although we have been doing it on a restricted level because we have been mainly only looking at two texts. In the article that you can get on the OLAP platform, you can get more. I have taken into account more, and I'm still working on a book. Hopefully, what was it? I'm hoping in the next maybe 2 years to complete that, where I'll be translating all the foundation accounts from the canonical sources and discussing them in detail. And there, the procedure is the historical critical one, where we say, for example, this and this is not found in this version, not found in that version, so it's probably later. We try to come as close as possible as we can to an earlier strata in the textual transmission. And the second one is the legal reading, where we are just trying to see one particular text, what are its legal implications. And what I find, obviously, and this is why I'm saying a problem arises when these two modes of reading are confused with each other, that some people invariably use mode number one, and others invariably mode number two. And this is where confusion arises. Mode number two is when somebody, say a Theravada monastic, a traditional Theravada monastic, takes the Theravada Vinaya as representing historical truth. This reading of the Vinaya just as it is the only correct one. The idea that the Theravada tradition preserves the Buddha Dharma in its pristine purity, has never changed anything, and so whatever is written there is not seen as the product of a long period of transmission with various influences, but as truth. The Theravada Vinaya says the Buddha said this and this, and so it must be exactly like that. This is obviously, and I think most of you would agree, overstepping the bounds of what mode number two can give us. Mode number two is an important form of reading, for example, the Theravada Vinaya, to understand its rules and regulations, but it is not an accurate account of what historically happened. But mode number one also has its limitations. If I want to know how I should keep my rules, it is pretty much irrelevant for me to start looking what these rules are in the Dhammaguptaka or Mulasavastivada Vinaya. I have ordained at the end of the 20th century, and I have ordained in the Theravada tradition. I have not been ordained by the Buddha. So for me to start investigating, 2,500 years ago, what may have been the origin, is pretty much irrelevant when I'm talking about Anāliyo now. How should he follow certain rules? For that, what is really relevant is the Theravada Vinaya, reading this and consulting what later tradition says. So this is, putting it very simple, how I think that we should be able to use both modes of reading according to circumstances, according to according to what we are trying to achieve, and not opt just for one, ignoring the other, and believing that one mode of reading can explain every situation. Some questions now. Liza Fancourt, former Bishop Maria Jepson, in a presentation to the Congress in 2007, mentions how women in religious leadership was feared to lead to the end of Christianity. Yeah. The idea runs through the human psyche narrative across religious traditions. Yeah, it's particularly, I think, in the Catholic tradition, this is a particular problem, that women should not take position of priest or even bishop. Maria Jepson is in the Protestant tradition. Yes, it's a general problem in different religious traditions, that there's a fear of women, and I would put this under ascetic misogyny, a fear of women that then spells itself out in this androcentric institution of androcentrism, the belief that the administration, the institution, has to be run by men. Sikkhamanabua, if it's required to train as a Sikkhamana for 2 years before becoming a bhikkhuni, why is it in the historical accounts of Sangamitta Thiri going to Sri Lanka to ordain women as bhikkhunis, Queen Anulai et al. Were able to ordain as bhikkhunis right away without going through Sikkhamana phase? Well, we do not know so exactly what happened. We are only told that they received the going forth, the pabbaja. It is not clear if we can exclude the possibility that they underwent such a Sikkhamana training. It is also not possible really to imagine that at the time when Buddhism was brought to Sri Lanka, the Sikkhamana training was not yet mentioned in the Vinaya, because we have it also in the other Vinayas. So the ordination of Queen Anula, I think, is not a clear point. We cannot argue in one or the other direction. This is my personal take on it. But please understand that I am not arguing that Sikkhamana training is a must. This is something anybody has to decide, but my personal understanding would be that if somebody decides to go forth in the Theravada tradition, particularly as a woman, in the present day difficult situation of where it is very important to be recognized by traditionalists, if I were in that situation, I would probably prefer to go through some sort of preparatory period. If I have already been a nun in, say, a Sila Dasa Sila Mata or Sila Dharini in the Ajahn Chah tradition or Tilashin in Burma, if I've already done such a 2-year training period, I would feel okay. But if I would ordain from zero, I would probably want to go through such a Sikkhamana training for 2 years just in order to make my taking of full ordination acceptable to traditional eyes. Because much of the opposition that the revival of the Bhikkhuni order experience in traditional countries is precisely this feeling they want to be Bhikkhunis, but they don't want to do it according to the Vinaya. This is a wrong perception. But I think it's important to be aware of the fact that this wrong perception needs to be countered by certain activities, such as trying to follow the Theravada Vinaya to the best of one's abilities. But this is obviously just my personal take. Yeah, there's a private message here, I think, and then there's a fan card that says, drawing a parallel to prediction of decline in other religious tradition. Yeah. So I think at this point I continue. Oh, there's Champa Tsegren. She says that Bishop Jepson became the first Lutheran female bishop worldwide. Yeah, even in the Protestant church, to become a female priest has been impossible for centuries. Yeah. It's a fascinating development how things slowly are opening up, and hopefully we are right on with the Buddhist tradition. Hopefully it will also be possible in the Catholic tradition. And Sikkhamana Bua, when you say historical accounts are unclear, does this mean it may be possible Sanghamitta Thera stayed on for 2 years to train Queen Anula as Sikkhamanas before giving full ordination? Well, if we go back, all we have is this verse account in the Vangsa literature, and I am not sure if we can take such a strong stand on them. What is the historical value? How much of details were they meant to give? But it seems, I mean, if I look at it from the historical perspective of the development of texts, as far as we are able to tell, the majority of the early discourses and the main parts of the Vinayas seem to have been in place by the time when the Buddhism moved to Sri Lanka and other countries. It is somewhat difficult to imagine that this idea of a Sikkhamana training only came up much later. So it seems to me more probable that it was already in place by that time. And if it was already in place, and I mean Mahinda is on a reputation for being an arahant, it's somewhat difficult to imagine that the text would show him as intentionally breaking that rule. So I personally feel that the story of the ordination of Queen Anula, I would simply leave it open. I would not take a strong position on that. And after all, the main reference point, if you ordain in the Theravada tradition, would be the Theravada Vinaya. And however much we may think that it may have later parts, it may be added on, but the Sikkhamana training is clearly there, not only in the Garuda Dhammas, it's also there in other parts of the Vinaya. So, as I said again, if I were like as a male monastic, I try to follow the Theravada Vinaya to the best of my abilities. And that sometimes requires some negotiation. And there are things like, Lisa said before, I'm not using money. And this in the modern day situation causes some rather absurd situations. And some of my academic colleagues find it rather strange. But I feel that having taken that decision to be a Theravada monk, a bhikkhu, and in order to negotiate my relationship with other traditional Theravada bhikkhus who live in Sri Lanka, who do not understand the living situation in the West, only it is important that they are receptive to my findings, to what I say. It is an essential aspect of my monastic conduct that I continue with a rule that I personally find irrelevant, that I personally would not freely choose to follow, precisely out of my understanding that I'm part of a major tradition. This tradition operates in a certain way, and I try to find a place where I'm comfortable with the demands of the tradition and the demands of modern-day situation. And so if I would put myself in the situation of being a female, wanting to take higher ordination, I would personally want to undergo the Sikkhamana training. Shall we leave it at that and continue? Some reading. So what I've put here together is the continuation of the foundation account, and now this latter part is only in the Vinaya. Gaudama is the part of the part that we also have in the Anguttara Nikaya. And the question that I'm presenting to the text now is like the main issue is how can bhikkhuni ordination be conducted? And the basic problem is, as topic to which we will be coming back in future lecture, is that the bhikkhuni order in the Theravada traditions died out. It reached Sri Lanka. We do not exactly know what happened in Burma, but in Sri Lanka it lasted for several centuries. But at a certain point, perhaps 9th, 10th century, around 10th century, I think, it came to an end during a time of warfare where also the monk order was seriously diminished. And from then on, there has not been a bhikkhuni order in the Theravada tradition. And the reason for that is that there is a general perception that in order to ordain a bhikkhuni, you need an already existing community of bhikkhunis, of nuns. And I believe that this idea, very widespread, is actually not correct. And this is the point I'm wanting to make now with this legal reading. The legal reading, we are just looking at the Theravada Vinaya, we're looking at what is really relevant, what is legally the precedent, the basis for such decision. So if we do this legal reading, we find that what obviously in the history as it is being constructed in the Theravada Vinaya, the first pronouncement by the Buddha is this Garudhamma, where he says a probationer, that is this Sikkhamana we have been discussing before, she has trained for 2 years in 6 rules, and then she should seek for higher ordination from both communities. This means that, and we are not talking history, we are talking legal reading. We are saying that according to the Theravada Vinaya, the first thing the Buddha says, he wants both communities, monks and nuns, together to be responsible for higher ordination. And in the story, the Gaudama is given to Mahaprajapati Gotami, and she accepts this. And it is the acceptance of this and the other 7 Gaudamas that makes her a nun. Now the next thing is she comes to the Buddha and says, Vanda, what should I do about these 500 women? They are these Shakyan women. They also want to become nuns. What should be done about them? And so here we get the first rule. This is the first time the Buddha actually addresses monks. He says, monks, I prescribe the giving of the higher ordination of nuns by monks. So again, we are reading the Theravada construction of this history. So according to this construction, it means the Buddha originally wanted both communities to do this ordination, but now there's only one nun. She is not a Sangha. For a Sangha, you need at least a number of nuns. So in a situation where there is no community of nuns, no bhikkhuni sangha, the Buddha says, monks, you ordain. So here is a very clear permission for monks on themselves to ordain nuns. Then the Vinaya continues, we get various stories that happened in between, and at a certain point we get this problem that, you know, as part of the monastic ritual of ordination, a candidate is asked certain questions. So some of these questions also have to find out if you're in debt, if you have done some major crime, and also if you are sexually abnormal. And some of the female candidates are embarrassed when they stand in front of the monks and they are being asked if their menstruation is normal, if their sexual genitals are normal, etc. They are just too shy to answer. And in that situation, again, we are legal reading, this is what the Vinaya tells us. In that situation, then the monks make, the Buddha makes this second ruling on the issue of bhikkhu ordination. This is the last part there, here on the screen, where he says, higher ordination in the community of monks, for one who has been higher ordained on one side and cleared herself in the community of nuns. So what this means is that, say if I'm now a female and I want to become a bhikkhuni, then after my 2 years of training, I first approach the community of nuns and they will ask me all the questions. Then they will ordain me, but I'm kind of half ordained, ordained on one side. And after that, I have to approach an order of monks. And these will also ordain me. And only when this whole procedure has been completed, am I considered to be a bhikkhuni according to Theravada law. Now the argument raised by traditionalists is very simple. It says, and now we just focus on these two, Chulabhaga 10.2 and Chulabhaga 10.17. As a basic principle in law, that when I make one regulation and later I make a second regulation, then automatically the last regulation will be valid. This is a basic principle in law. And even some have pointed out that, but the Buddha did never abolish the first, that is 10.2. He never abolished that. But nevertheless, the basic thrust of law, be it Vinaya law or other law, is always the last regulation is relevant. And when I studied this, I found that this actually is not a valid explanation. And I have not come across what I'm going to present to you now in other writings, but it seems to me that this basic argument overlooks the narrative context. And when we look at Vinaya law, we always have to look at the narrative context to understand what a particular regulation means. So before I come back to that, let me give you an example. Say we are here, I'm sitting here in Germany in the countryside, and the city council, there's a highway a little bit further away, the city council makes a law, first law. You are allowed to drive 100 kilometers per hour. This would be like our rule 10.2. Okay? Now, a little later, the city council makes another law. It says, you are allowed to drive 50 kilometers per hour. Obviously, there is no need for the city council to abolish the first rule. From the moment they make the second rule, 50 kilometers per hour is the valid regulation. And okay, I don't drive a car, but if I would be driving a car and I go on the highway and I go, say, 70 or 80 and police stops me, then there's no way for me to say, hey, look, 100 kilometers per hour was the earlier rule. What are you coming? They will say, no. This is wrong. The last regulation made by the city council is 50 kilometers per hour. What are you doing? However, the situation changes entirely when we find out that the first law made by the city council for 100 kilometers per hour was indeed for the highway. But the second law on 50 kilometers per hour was for city traffic. Two rules on the same issue of tempo limitation, but referring to different situations. Even after the city council said, when you drive in city or in town, don't drive more than 50 kilometers per hour, I can still go up to 100 on the highway. It's just a different situation. And I think this basic principle of law, a rule on exactly the same issue, does indeed replace an earlier rule. But if it refers to something different, then it does not replace it. Otherwise, in all law systems, we would only have one single law and everything else would be abolished. This explains, in this particular situation of Theravada Vinaya, because if we remember, 10.2 was given in a situation where no bhikkhuni order was in existence. The Buddha, according to the Vinaya, in Garudama 6 says, I want both communities to give bhikkhuni ordination. But when he's being directly asked, look, Bhante, I'm alone. There are no other nuns here. How should I do? He says, then the bhikkhu should do it. The bhikkhu's alone. And the second rule is given in a different situation. It's given in a situation where a bhikkhuni order is in existence. In such a situation, it should be done. This is specifically Theravada Vinaya. It's different in the Mula Savasivada Vinaya. That first of all, the nuns ordain and then the monks ordain. When we keep in mind this difference, we see that the arguments raised by traditionalists that 10.17 invalidates 10.2, they're actually wrong. They're plain wrong. They are not in accordance with the Theravada Vinaya. According to the Theravada Vinaya, and leave aside historical, critical, leave aside other Vinayas, according to the Theravada Vinaya, bhikkhus are expected to give ordination to nuns if there is no nun community in existence. As soon as they have done that, a bhikkhuni order has come into being, then the second rule is valid, 10.17, and from then onwards, dual ordination should be carried out. Yeah, you see, legal reading. Let me see some questions. Can you say something about the dating of the Madhyama Agama in comparison to the Mula Savastivada Vinaya? The Madhyama Agama still falls into the corpus of texts that I refer to as early discourses. And I have, in all my work with this collection, not come across any evidence of pronounced later influence, especially not in China. So it would be on a par with the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length collection. And I would place it as in the main representing the first two centuries in the development of Buddhism. The Mula Savastivada Vinaya has been open to later influences for considerable time. So it has some very early passages, but it also has some passages and descriptions that clearly reflect a later period. The Mula Savastivada Vinaya is a fantastic account, collection of narratives. It's a very powerful text full of different descriptions, but some of these descriptions show that we are clearly at a later period of time. The term for one who has been higher ordained on one side is not Upasampada, isn't it? If not, why the same translation then? Ekato Upasampada, I think it is the term. No? Yeah, it's also Upasampada, but on one side. So, oh, we are perfectly in time. I have another 2 minutes. Coming back to the main points that I would like you to take along from this lecture, the three types of attitudes towards women, soteriological inclusiveness, institutional androcentrism, and ascetic misogyny. All of these three attitudes are evident in the texts and also in modern day situations. And then the other point I would like you to take along is that reading Vinaya or reading any text, there are different ways of reading. And for the reading of Vinaya in particular, it's important for us to distinguish between a historical reading and a legal reading. Each of these is not absolute truth in itself. Each of these has its functions within a particular context. And as I hope to have shown, that a historical reading of the foundation account can give us very new and interesting perspective, and even a legal reading can bring up surprising results. So last question. In the case when bhikkhus only ordain women as bhikkhunis, is the procedure Kamavacha used the same as what is used for bhikkhus part in the case of a dual sangha ordination? No precept is mentioned in the bhikkhus part, so in case of bhikkhu only given ordination, is there anyone who serves as the preceptor for being the bhikkhuni ordained? Who then guides her in first years of bhikkhuni ordination, e.g. as was done in 1998 in Bodh Gaya ordination? Well, the Bodh Gaya ordination actually combined both, and this is what, in my understanding, makes it stand on very, very firm legal grounds. Because they were first taking, and at least the Sri Lankan Dhammula group, they were first taking ordination in the dual manner, based on the bhikkhunis from the Dharmaguptaka tradition, which goes back to the Theravada tradition insofar as we know that Sri Lankan bhikkhunis brought the ordination to China. This is something I think Ann Herrmann will be talking about in the next lecture next week. But the problem from the perspective of a traditionalist is that the present-day Dharmaguptaka bhikkhunis do not follow the Theravada Vinaya. Seems that in the 10th or 11th century, this is another finding by Ann Herrmann, the emperor of China simply made a law and said everybody has to follow Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. Up to that point, we had some monastics following Dharmaguptaka, others Sarvastivada, etc. There were different Vinayas, observed in China. So in the present day situation, the bhikkhunis from the Dharmaguptaka, bhikshunis from the Dharmaguptaka tradition no longer follow the Theravada Vinaya. And these two Vinayas are very closely related historically, but they differ in some respects. Some more rules here, some rules formulated differently. And again, from an entirely traditionalist or legalist perspective, it is difficult to see how somebody who is endowed with one particular Vinaya code could give ordination in a different Vinaya tradition. The issue is, one can of course make allowance for that, and I would personally make such allowances, but it should be understood also why traditionalists find this unacceptable. It's a little bit like, say I'm a lawyer, or let me be a policeman. Let me be a policeman in Germany. Can I go to France and arrest someone? I can't, no? I can arrest the Frenchman, let him be a gangster, when he comes to Germany, when he is within the sphere of where I take my legal power from as a German policeman. But I cannot just go into France and arrest somebody, or if I'm a judge, bring him to court, etc. For that, somebody is needed who is based on the French law. And so it is, from a traditional perspective, difficult to see how somebody who has Dharmaguptaka ordination could ordain somebody into the Theravada tradition or the Mula Sarvastivada tradition. This is by traditionalists seen as improper procedure and a legal act that is not really valid. Again, in a situation where there is no other option, and one has the wish, and I think many do have that wish, to revive or install an order of bhikkhunis, one could find ways of handling that situation. But there will always be objections. And this is particularly relevant also to the Tibetan tradition, just to move a little bit away from Theravada for a moment, where at present His Holiness has been very active supporting the attempts to restore bhikkhuni order, bhikshuni order, and lately the Karmapa has taken a very strong stance, very impressive. And so there the question is, what is the best way to do it? And I think here we have the precedent from the Bodh Gaya ordination, because attempts to start bhikkhuni ordination in the Theravada traditions have a long history, but they have so far not been really successful. What was really successful is the Bodh Gaya ordination, in particular the Sri Lankan group that is located at Dhambula. And what they did is, they did this dual ordination, but the dual ordination was undertaken in such a way that they were wearing Theravada robes and they were wearing Theravada bowls, etc. And after that dual ordination, they did another ordination only by monks. And so in this way, they have basically fulfilled the both requirements, if you like. The female candidates have tried to their best to go through a dual ordination. And for those who, including myself, think that this is actually sufficient, I would see Dharmaguptaka or Mula Sarvastivada bhikkhunis as bhikkhunis in such a situation, my personal opinion. This clarifies that situation. But then the traditionalists, as I said before, they will say, no, 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 no. These bhikkhunis do not follow Theravada Vinaya. They are not endowed with the right to give full ordination. I find this unacceptable. Anybody who takes that position implicitly says there is no Theravada bhikkhuni order in existence. Saying that means that we come back, let me just go back here, we come back to 10.2. We are in the situation, there is no Theravada bhikkhuni order able to give ordination. And then rule 10.2 applies. Monks alone can do it. So in this combination of both, according to my understanding, according to my research, has resulted in founding an ordination tradition that, as far as I can see, cannot be faulted. And my personal impression is that in the Tibetan tradition, something similar, but reversing the order would be the ideal solution, because in the Tibetan tradition there is the belief, the ritual component of the transmission is more important, and so it would be very important at the first stage to make sure that the vow received is Mulasavastivada. So if I had to give my personal opinion, I would say, let's start with an ordination given just by Mula Savastivada monks. And Venerable Champa Tsedrin, in a paper published last year in Journal of Buddhist Ethics, has shown that this is an option that the Mula Savastivada Vinaya allows. The allowance is different than what we have been seeing in the Theravada, but it seems to be possible. And after that, I would then bring in a dual ordination using Mula Savastivada monks and those who have ordained in the Dharmaguptaka tradition but are following the Tibetan form of practice and who are wearing Tibetan robes, like Champa Tsedlun, Kamalekshe Tsoma, etc., who are here. In my personal understanding, that would be a way of taking out as much as possible potential controversies. Because in the end, what this is all about is about creating something that is in harmony. It does not lead to dispute. And for that it is important, now I come back to my last point, that we do not... That we do not confound these two readings, the historical and the legal one. And that we understand, and this is also what I took away from the 2007 conference, that we really understand the concerns of traditionalists, and try to integrate them, take them along in the overall vision of whatever we then recommend to those who want to enter the tradition, the procedure to follow. Yeah, and then the actual way you're asking about how this is to be done, I think this has simply to be sorted out according to situation, because the problem is somewhat complex, and I think also if I continue to answer that question, I'm really going over time now. So maybe we conclude at that point. Again, what I'd like you to take along is these three types of attitudes and the two ways of reading the Vinaya. Thank you so much for your attention. I hope it has been a little bit interesting and entertaining and not too boring to get into all these Vinaya details and trying to understand. And I really look forward to the lectures that are going to come. So many different scholars have kindly agreed to present in this course, and I think that for myself, and I think for many of us, there are lots to learn. Thank you, and